most businesses need to show some evidence that the money they're spending is well spent. And depending on the business, that means showing different things. But for the VA, can they show that veterans are getting better for all this money that they're paying for the care that the VA pays for? My belief is they can't, and they won't, and they never have shown that. So why do we keep putting billions of dollars into a healthcare program that has no ability to show one lick of efficacy? Where is that veteran that got better? They should have reams of administrative data. And they do. But I've never seen it. When other people have asked for it, they have not been given it. That to me is the most mystifying piece of all of this. How is it that Congress never asks that question?
Team, welcome back to another week with Drew and Alex. I do, before we get started, want to issue an apology. In our last episode, we revealed the winner of British Bake Off, apparently before a couple of people had seen the finale and proceeded to then spoil and ruin the entire season for them. So this is an official apology on behalf of both Alex and myself. As everyone knows, Mops and Moes is on the cutting edge of British Bake Off news. So we'll be right there on the front lines next season, and we will be sure to do our best to possibly maybe not reveal the winner. But I say that we'll probably ruin it for you guys again next year. So apologies. Anyway, Alex.
Real fans would have been up to speed.
Real fans would have watched it live, but you know, that different conversation for a different day.
We did delay a whole week.
We did. And yeah. If you still haven't seen the finale, Maddie wins. So,
spoiler alert.
Yeah.
He's not that
also,
sorry.
Whoops. Anyway, Merry Christmas. Who are we talking to this week?
All right. Today, we are talking to Chris Free. He's a PhD clinical psychologist by training and professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. He has over 30 years of professional experience working with military veterans and active duty personnel and has conducted clinical trials, epidemiology, historical, and neuroscience research. He has co-authored over 300 scientific publications, including a graduate textbook on adult psychopathology. Currently, his work on operator syndrome is helping change the way we understand and treat the complex set of interrelated health, psychological, and interpersonal difficulties that are common downstream outcomes of a career in military special operations. Due to that, he has a slew of advisory roles, SEAL Future Foundation, Boulder Crest Foundation, Military Special Operations Family Collaborative, The Mission Within, Vets Inc., Quick Reaction Foundation, and with the military special operations community in general. We're actually going to have him back in a couple months to focus on that, because he has a book on operator syndrome coming out. But on this episode, we're going to focus on his time at the VA, where he worked from 1991 to 2006. Specifically, we're digging into how the VA approaches mental health issues. Chris has testified before the U.S. Congress, served as a paid contractor for the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, U.S. State Department, and the National Board of Medical Examiners. He's been published, quoted, and cited in a huge range of publications, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Reuters, and many others. And I think once you get into the conversation here, you'll see why.
So a couple of things to point out at the top. Number one, I'm recovering from a cold, which is why I have this phenomenal podcast voice going on. This conversation came off the back end of the episode we did some time ago with Dan Gade and the Wounding Warriors book, which if you haven't listened to that one yet, I think is definitely worth your time to give you sort of a foundational knowledge of where we're coming from with these conversations around the VA. And that kind of leads into the next point I want to make, which is why is a podcast on military fitness kind of taking, I don't want to say taking shots, but having conversations with folks that have been somewhat critical of VA policy, et cetera. The reason for it, and we've mentioned this before, the whole point of embedded human performance from where Alex and I sit and kind of our opinion on this is this idea of subject matter experts being resourced to increase the readiness, increase the health, increase the lethality of soldiers, airmen, Marines, whichever branch you're in. And what's interesting is that that system exists alongside a system that effectively rewards or financially incentivizes those same soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors to be broken or to be less than healthy. And that's not to say that we're here to knock on anybody who is legitimately seeking care through that VA system. Like we said in this podcast, like we said in the one with Dan, there's a lot of goodness coming out of the VA, but there's certainly some interesting conversations to be had around that system. And I think Chris is uniquely positioned because while in that system, he tried to ask some of those questions and was effectively shut down. And I'll let him dive into that because he does a great job of it, obviously, in kind of the back half of the episode. But again, I think that we do get some questions around, like, what does that have to do with, you know, MOPS and MOS and PT and blah, 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 blah. And I think if you take a step back and kind of look at the broader system, it definitely has its place. So just the two points I wanted to make. One, I'm sick. Two, this episode is very relevant.
Yeah, we've, over the course of kind of having the conversations we've had on this platform, we've definitely seen how the topic of military health and fitness can quickly spiral into a lot of different things. But we know this is one that a lot of people are very interested in. It's one of those kind of goal metrics of improving human performance programs in the military is to make a positive impact on some of these outcomes. And there's a lot of strong opinions. We mentioned the term third rail in this episode, talking about certain topics you're not allowed to talk about, right? And that is a pretty good indicator that there's an important conversation there that probably should happen. So that's what we're trying to do here. Very similar to kind of the conversation we had with Dan Gade. But yeah, I think I'm sure some people will be a little bit upset by some of the statements that are made in this episode. I'm sure some people will agree strongly with some of the statements that are made in this episode. And I'm looking forward to the conversations that come from this.
Where does the third rail phrase come from? Do you know?
The like electrified rail on like metro tracks that theoretically, if you touch it, you get electrified and die.
Well, there you go. And I looked it up just in case you didn't have the answer. And as you mentioned, this is certainly a third rail episode. Wikipedia defines it as a metaphor for any issue so controversial that it is quote charged and untouchable. So with that, enjoy. Hey guys, before we kick this episode off, just wanted to give a quick plug to the two options that we have for folks interested in training with us. We have the team-based Long and Strong program. And then if you are interested in a more engaging, intensive, more tailored option, we offer one-on-one coaching as well.
And you can find both of those on the training tab of our website, mopsandmos.com. And if it's the team training you're interested, click that link and you will find a 1 week free trial.
So again, if any of the things that we talk about on this podcast are interesting to you as far as training goes, head to the website, like Alex just mentioned, select that training tab and follow the instructions from there. Enjoy the episode. This isn't necessarily a podcast question, but just out of curiosity, like what is a peacetime VA versus a wartime VA feel like, look like?
Yeah, when I left the VA, we were just starting to get the OAF, OIF veterans coming in. So most of my VA experience was with the wars, veterans of the wars that came before 9/11.
Right. Do you think that changed either like the culture at the VA, the way the VA operated, what the priorities were, or was it mostly more of the same?
Yeah, I think so. I think it changed things. One thing, I mean, here's just a data point, was that for the 15 years I worked at the VA, there were three of us in the PTSD clinic. One social worker, one psychiatrist, one psychologist. And it was the same three of us all those years. I was friends with the people who came behind me. In fact, I persuaded a good friend to come to the VA and take my role when I left. And I went back to Charleston pretty frequently for about 4 years after I moved away. And the entire mental health program at the Charleston VA had, it had grown by leaps and bounds. Like it had quadrupled in size, the number of clinicians. So they blew it up much bigger, very quickly after I left.
So this obviously seems pretty obvious, but my assumption would be that that was as a result of sort of what we've seen culturally as far as mental health awareness and just acknowledgement goes. And we've had a couple of people on here that have talked about kind of the same thing, but the fact that there was only three of you guys for 15 years seems insane.
Just was what it was. maybe they had to hire 10 people just to replace me, but that's probably not really what was going on. I think they had a lot more veterans coming in needing services.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to talk a lot about PTSD, but there's one question I wanted to ask you specifically because of research you've done, and it's been a hot topic in the veteran space. It's been a hot topic in the military space. And I'm curious, you can correct me if I'm wrong on the scope of this project, but you did a historical analysis on U.S. Army suicides all the way back to 1819. That's a huge scope. You're covering generations and entirely different eras and things like that. What did that analysis reveal? Were there takeaways from that that you think are applicable now? What was the purpose there?
Well, that's a really good question. You've done some reading in your homework. So I'll go back about 10, 12 years ago. I don't remember the exact year, but we hired a new history professor here at the University of Hawaii. And the first month or so that he was on campus, I invited him to my office for a conversation. He was a brand new, wet behind the ears, assistant professor, historian of American history. So he came to my office. I had a small, I was a chair of the division or something like that. So I had a small administrative role. And he was sitting in with me talking in my office, and he noticed that I have more Civil War books on my shelves than I did psychology books. And the Civil War was his area. Jeff Smith, brilliant guy. He just left last summer. And he asked me, he said, well, what was the PTSD like during the Civil War? I said, we don't know. Well, it wasn't a diagnosis. There would be no data on it. He said, well, would they have collected data on other things related to mental health or functioning? And I said, well, I doubt it. I mean, we didn't, 1860s was not a time known for its understanding of mental health and awareness. Moreover, were they tracking anything during the war? And I was pretty sure that the answer to all of that was no. He left my office and came back 10 minutes later and said, you're wrong. I'm like, what do you mean I'm wrong? When am I ever wrong? And he pointed us, he said that the Surgeon General of the United States published a book. I think it was published a few years after the war. But during the war, they had run a very large medical and behavioral health surveillance program throughout the entire war. And the question was, how could we get a copy of this book? Now, what we came to learn was it was not one volume. It's a series of volumes. And on a bookshelf, it takes up about 2 feet, maybe more. It's like an encyclopedia set. But it included a book of tables. And the tables were very meticulous charts and graphs, but with numbers that were broken down by year and month of the war, theater of operations, officers versus enlisted, even blacks and whites. And they tracked, I think it was 182 different health conditions, many of which you would expect: gunshot wounds, shrapnel. They also tracked things like heart attacks, diabetes, and they homicides, and suicides. So they were counting suicides of U.S. Army soldiers during the war itself. And we could even pinpoint when and where in the war those suicides occurred. That blew my mind. And as we went looking to see who else had looked at the stuff or written on it, nobody had. There was one historian who had written a couple of short articles more characterizing the effort. They didn't go into the numbers of the data. So we decided, well, we need to get this book. We need to get this collection of volumes and really, really take a look at it. It turns out we could find one copy on Amazon, and we found one copy in the Library of Congress, and we found one copy in a couple other libraries around the country. And the one copy on Amazon was $3,000, I believe. but it was worth it. We bought it, and I'm sure it's sitting on my colleague's shelf to this day. So that was kind of the beginning of our historical look at suicides in times of war. And we published a paper specifically on this in 2012. We found there were fewer suicides in the Army during the whole 4 years of the war than there had been the year we wrote the paper, current times. So we're seeing more active duty suicides modern times than we saw 4 years of the Civil War in the 1860s. It's interesting. It's interesting, but what does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows. We have a fair degree of confidence in the numbers. Obviously, nothing can be proven, nothing can be fully demonstrated, but they got a lot of things right in the process of this project. I think one thing we concluded is combat, even horrific combat, and that's what the Civil War was, is not necessarily the primary driver of suicides in soldiers. After we did that study, we worked with a couple other historians, and we did a longer, more, we went back to 1819 and looked at it all the way up till now. And we tried to do it for all branches of the U.S. military. Only the Army had the data, or only the Army would share the data. And I think it was maybe a little bit of both, but I think really the Army was the only branch that had good systematic data on suicides. And so we published that paper, and then we've since published another paper this just came out earlier this year, putting the rate line of suicides of active duty soldiers going back to 1900 and putting that on the same graph with the rate of suicides in civilians in America. And the lines move, the lines are parallel, except that when one goes up, when the civilian suicides go up, military suicides go up even more. So it's an exaggerated response, or it's a more striking and dramatic response.
So, and this is like at risk of taking us down a tangent, because I know we're going to get to PTSD in a second, but focusing on the suicide for a second, you mentioned that you found that like during the Civil War, you don't think it was necessarily combat exposure that was a direct driver of suicides. And I could be wrong here, but my understanding of the data today is that that is also the same thing. Like combat deployment doesn't significantly change the rate or the suicide risk in military populations. Do you have like any particular insight into what things you do think are more direct drivers and what role combat does play?
Well, so, I mean, I agree with your interpretation, and that's what we concluded in our paper that was published earlier this year, that there are probably societal forces that are driving suicides for both veterans, Army, and active duty, but also for civilians. And it's complicated, it's complex, I'm sure it's multifactorial. It's not just one thing. But we got a lot of things going on in our society right now, and we're seeing higher rates of suicide among civilians across age groups.
So shifting gears a little bit into PTSD. Another piece you wrote was titled Assessment and Treatment Planning for PTSD. And so I guess the first question related to that one is, how well implemented do you think some of those evidence-based treatments are?
So it's an interesting question. Can you clarify, are where? How well are they implemented in the VA system? Implemented in DOD, implemented in civilian.
Let's go VA in the VA system.
Well, it's hard for me to say because I'm no longer in the VA and it's been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What I can say, and I think the VA is very open about this, is they make a real effort to provide psychiatric medications and psychotherapy mm-hmm. for veterans with PTSD. And those are two of the right treatments to offer. So that's all to the good. Do they offer quality care? I think probably for the most part. What do the therapists do in terms of therapy? I think they do a wide range of different types of therapies. I don't really have any particular reason to criticize the VA on what the clinicians are providing to their mm-hmm. patients. I do have several thoughts, though, that are adjacent to your question. One is I think the VA has put way too much emphasis on PTSD to the detriment of ignoring and dismissing other types of injuries.
Mm-hmm.
So they've made the PTSD the easy button. You're a combat veteran, you served in a combat war zone overseas, welcome home, and here's your PTSD diagnosis and everything that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's overdiagnosed. And we can go as deep into that as you want, but a very simple data point is the epidemiological studies pretty consistently show that the rate of expected combat PTSD is about 8%. And yet the VA, right now, we have over half, I don't know the exact number, but I'm pretty sure it's over half of all OEF, OIF veterans now are diagnosed with PTSD. So it's way overdiagnosed if you just look at the epidemiological data from what you would expect.
Do you think that some of that might come from a fear of missing a diagnosis? So like, I guess what I'm asking is like, hey, let's subconsciously, consciously, whatever, but like, let's overdiagnose because one, like you mentioned, it's the easy button. But then two, it's like, man, if we miss, like, it just seems like it's almost politicized at this point, yeah. if that is fair yeah. to say.
Well, it is politicized. And I think there is a very well-intentioned impulse to overdiagnose rather than underdiagnose.
Mm-hmm.
And we can all agree that probably for most of our history as a nation, our veterans have not received much in the way of quality mental health care when they needed it. But I think in doing so, we are ignoring other injuries that we should be paying more attention to, such as blast exposures.
Hmm.
You've probably seen the New York Times has run a series of articles over the last few months on about blast exposures and how they affect the brain. And this is not new thinking. This was the understanding of shell shock during World War I. We understood it as a neurological condition caused by the blinding, flashing, loud booms of artillery. In a weird sort of way, I think we're circling back to where we were over 100 years ago in understanding this. But the hormonal injuries, the chronic pain, the sleep apnea, which is really high, at least in operators, it's very high in people who have a lot of blast exposures.
I do wonder, because I'll lay some stuff out for the audience, because I don't know how much people have followed the news and the updates on blast exposure kind of stuff. But I think a troubling part of that picture is how much of the blast exposure comes from training, where we do control that exposure rather than kind of unavoidable exposure mm-hmm. to enemy yes. artillery fire or something like that.
Yep.
And yes. I think that going back to like the political nature of some of these things, I think there's a troubling admission that has to be made. If we acknowledge the pervasiveness of blast exposure caused mm-hmm. by training when we knew the consequences of that exposure, that's a hard look versus PTSD, where we can blame it on exposure to the enemy, and that might be a little bit more comfortable.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. But when you look at what military training does for certain groups, certain occupational specialties, my work is lately, last decade and plus, has been mostly with special operations. And when you realize that what they do, what a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret or a Marine Raider or an Air Force pararescueman does, they are exposed to these, they do these training evolutions 3 months at a time, or shorter or longer. But for example, welcome to breaching school. Mm. For the next 3 months, you're going to be laying charges every day and blowing stuff up. And then you're going to go over there and you're going to learn how to fire, you know, shoulder fire rockets. And you're going to do that every day. And then think about those instructors standing on the field between the guys firing the shoulder fire rockets. And then you got the combat diving. You've got the parachute jumps. You've got the rappelling out of helicopters. None of these are easy on the brain. So I would estimate that the rate of TBI, traumatic brain injury, at least in military special operations with operators, is probably 95% before they ever do a single overseas deployment.
Hmm. How do you, and this may be a rhetorical question, but like just thinking out loud, like how do you even prevent that from happening? The nature of the beast is that you kind of do have to expose yourself to those sort of things. So I guess maybe the focus should be more on the treatment than the prevention, or am I completely off the mark?
Well, I'm at the limits of my expertise on that. Yeah, question.
Well, I figured the three of us were at this point.
I don't know what they should do.
Yeah.
And so I don't criticize what they're doing. And I certainly agree, you know, there is, to a certain extent, you got to do the training in order to do the job. Mm-hmm. And there really aren't shortcuts. I think smarter people than me probably could engineer some scenarios and some protective gear and develop some ways of doing some of that training with less risk, less damage. Mm-hmm. But then on the side of things, that's a huge piece of this, is what could we be doing during the course of a career? And what do we need to be ready to do immediately at the end of a career?
Well, and so that last point kind of brings me back to the start of this line of questioning, which had to do with the treatment options that we're looking at as far as PTSD goes. And one of the things that we have, I guess, maybe inadvertently explored on a couple of episodes here, just because of the folks that we've had on that have experienced PTSD, there seems to be a growing conversation around alternative medications, functional medications, okay, Eastern medicine, yes, this type of thing, yes, call it drugs, call it whatever. I'm curious, with your expertise, what you kind of think about that conversation.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, because that was a few minutes ago. I said I had two or three points to make, and that's one of them.
Perfect. We love that point.
The treatment that the VA offers, I mean, I'm not criticizing medications and psychotherapies. Those are foundational in that they need to do what they're doing on those fronts. But there are other treatments that they can be providing, and I think, in my opinion, they should be providing. Real easy, low-hanging fruit there, stellate ganglion block therapy.
Hmm. Can you just explain what that is first before we go? Because I know some people have no clue.
Sure, most people have no clue, including most mental health practitioners. So stellate ganglion block is a treatment where they put the stellate ganglion block. Stellate ganglion, is your nerve. It's this collection of nerves that runs down your spinal column, central nervous system. It's essentially our fight or flight nervous system, our sympathetic nervous system. So neurologists have been treating headaches for about 100 years, certain types of headaches, with stellate ganglion block as a procedure. So it's not new. It's been around 100 years. About a decade ago, a couple neurologists at Fort Bragg noticed, hey, when we treat a soldier for their headaches, they also get more relaxed and they start sleeping better, which is awesome. Is it an accidental finding? Is that's something they wondered about? Is this coincidence or is there a causative thing here? So they did the randomized controlled medical trials, and other people have now done trials. Stellate ganglion block is a very effective treatment for reducing anxiety. And here's what it is. It's a one-time medical procedure that involves injecting a little bit of lidocaine or novocaine into the stellate ganglion nerve, which they can access at the side of the neck. So it's literally doing a one-time injection into the side of the neck, into that nerve system that just brings down, it turns down the volume on your anxiety. It works almost immediately, like within hours, usually at least by the next day. It will bring profound relief of anxiety and tension in the body, and people who receive it start sleeping better right off the bat, almost right away. Safe. It's the side effects. The only side effect is that it causes a little facial drooping, and that goes away after 3 or 4 hours. So it's sort of no big deal. The medication in stellate ganglion block will wear off. The benefits might last for 3 to 6 months, might last up to a year. Some people don't even notice when the medicine wears off because they've been sleeping better and functioning better and engaging in therapy and doing other things for themselves. You can go back and have it done again. So I know several people who've had the SGB done 3 or 4 times. But why are we not just doing that for everybody right off the bat?
So I'm going to ask you that as a question. Why is it not more widespread?
I don't know. Part of it is because it's new. Part of it is because clinicians, like everybody else, are old-fashioned and set in our ways. We do what we've learned, and we keep doing things the way we've learned to do them. This is a bit of a paradigm shift. Frankly, it's a bit of a disruptor. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys get stellate ganglion block therapy, and they're like, "Wow, I'm feeling great. I don't need medication." So that's just one treatment, and there's others.
Is there a financial motivation for sticking with more of a pharmacological approach to this kind of thing? Do you think, and I don't mean that nefariously, but like, I would imagine if somebody comes to the table with, "Hey man, no pun intended, but like one shot, one kill, we can kind of solve for this individual's anxiety, you know, sleep, whatever," versus we can keep him on a drip of pills for the rest of his life. I'm curious if there's any sense of that.
I don't think there's a nefarious conspiracy in that way, but I do believe that humans don't like to have their work disrupted. And so if I'm working with a certain type of widget and I'm an expert in that widget and I use that widget on everything, and then somebody comes along who has a new and improved widget that's completely different from what I'm able to do, that disrupts my ability to maybe do what I want to do. And people are resistant to that.
I just want to point out for people that are listening, the reason we're sitting here chuckling is because I keep having balloons float across my Zoom screen. So if anyone listening knows how to fix that, let us know before the next episode. Because Chris, I do want to uncover some of the other treatments that you did talk about, because I know we sort of interrupted to go down more rabbit holes, but we touched on that one. What are some of the other ones?
Ketamine infusion. Ketamine infusion is a very powerful treatment. I wouldn't say it's necessarily better than other treatments, but I would say it should certainly be one of the things that we provide our veterans. Ketamine is a hallucinogen. It's also an anesthetic. It is FDA approved now as a treatment for depression. 4 to 8 sessions of ketamine infusion, and I'm a fan of infusion. I'm not a big fan of tablets or other methods of delivery, but a ketamine infusion where you sit in a chair comfortably for an hour with eye shades on, and they run the ketamine into your body intravenously, and then they shut it off after about an hour or so, and you sit there till your head clears, and then you go home and you're done for the day. 4 to 8 of those sessions are very powerful. We also think that ketamine and SGB may also help with neurogenerativity, neuroplasticity. It might help the brain heal itself. And there are studies now that I think are ongoing, clinical trials to explore and evaluate that hypothesis very specifically.
So I'm going to bring us to a topic you've researched and discussed before that I think is somewhat sensitive. I think people don't necessarily react well to conversations about it all the time, but you've done some work on things like exaggeration of symptoms, malingering, misrepresentation of combat exposure, things like that. I'd love to hear about some of your findings in that space and what they mean for some of the research in mental health treatment, and I guess also the ramifications for disability as well.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the disability. Let's start with the policy itself. So the VA's policy essentially is if you're injured, you're a soldier and you're injured in the course of your service to your country, we owe you a debt. We're going to take care of that injury. And if you can't work because of that injury, we're going to give you income replacement. It's well-intentioned and it's the right thing to do at a conceptual level. I think, however, we now live in an age and in a society where most of us are not manual laborers anymore. If you were a soldier in the Civil War and you lost an arm or a leg and you came home, it was hard for you to do your work on the farm. Now, they didn't have these disability policies in place back then. These came later in the 20th century. But ask yourself this question. Does it make sense to offer lifetime disability to somebody merely because they have a psychiatric illness? If we follow that line of reasoning, probably the best epidemiological study we have in America of mental illness was done in 2005. There have been updates, but not at this magnitude. Kessler and his team studied almost 10,000 Americans, stratified so that they were truly representative of America, general population. Half of us, almost 50%, had a psychiatric illness, either at the time of their study or lifetime. So having a psychiatric illness is not rare. It's one in two. Now, that doesn't mean everybody in that 50% with psychiatric illness has it at a severe level. Most don't. But let's acknowledge we have treatments now for mental illness. Why offer a lifetime of disability? Why say to a veteran, you're now a psychiatric invalid, and we're going to send you a check every month for the rest of your life to cover that? Now, if it was a safety net that's just there for everybody and there was no disability associated with it, okay, that's a different thing. I'm not arguing against that. If it's a short-term safety net, hey, we're gonna give you income replacement for 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, whatever it takes until you're better, I probably don't have a problem with that either. But a lifetime disability, it just doesn't make sense in today's modern age when we have treatments for psychiatric illnesses that are very effective.
So I'm going to do something I'm routinely guilty of on this podcast, which is instead of asking a question, I'm just going to say a bunch of stuff and I'm not going to like wrap it up with a good question. I'm just going to let you respond to it.
Okay.
Some of this is coming from other research I've read and things like that, other books.
I like the preface, the preamble to the...
Yeah,
The pre-ramble.
Just the difference in propensity to recover between people with the same condition who are either compensated for that condition or not compensated for that condition, and then tied in with that, an assumption that certain conditions are chronic, particularly among compensated and veteran populations, when those same conditions are seen as temporary and or treatable in other populations. Like I said, I don't have a question mark at the end of that. That's just a statement, and I'm going to let you go with it.
You just said it, and you said it well, and I agree with what you just said. We have treatments for PTSD. that should help people get better. That should be the expectation we communicate. If we diagnose you with PTSD, we're going to give you treatment, and we think you're going to get better, maybe entirely better, maybe mostly better, maybe only partially better, but we won't know until we do the treatment, and then we make decisions from there. If you're adjudicated as disabled and we're paying you money, how can you get better? There's an old saying in medicine, it's impossible to get better when at the same time you're trying to prove that you're still sick. Because at least at the theoretical level, if your PTSD gets better, you give up your disability. And I heard that from my patients all the time when I worked at the VA. Hey, thank you, they would say. This treatment is really helping me. I'm doing so much better. Thank you. They would express appreciation. And then they would say, please don't put this in my record because I don't want to lose my disability. Please don't document in my medical record that I am getting better, was essentially what I and VA clinicians hear all the time. Yeah. Is there malingering? Is there overrepresenting? Of course there is. But we also have to acknowledge that people are rational actors.
Yeah, we have created an incentive structure for them that they are responding to. Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. We've created an incentive structure that distorts their behavior and encourages them to behave in ways that are not healthy for them, not healthy for their families, and certainly not healthy for our entire society. I think very highly of our military veterans. I want them working. I want them in our economy. I want them in leadership positions. I want them working in places that matter.
How do you fix it? I know that's the $1 million question. Again, no pun intended, but because we've asked this before. We asked this to Dan Gade as well. But like, it's almost this question of how do you reverse that? The beast that has been created insofar as sort of the compensation for being quote unquote injured.
I think you have to look at who are the vested powers that have the most interest in maintaining the status quo. And my answer to that question is it's the VA itself. The VA is an empire full of little small empires, some of which aren't so small. You've got the National Centers for PTSD. I think there's 7 or 8 of them spread around the country. They have line item budgets. There's no accountability. They have a guaranteed budget for what they want to do. So do they want to see things change? Do they want to see PTSD become less of a factor, less of a force? That's one question I would ask. The other group I think that may have a vested interest in the disability status quo are the veteran service organizations, the big 5 VSOs. They're on Capitol Hill, constantly lobbying for more resources, more money, make that pie bigger. They're not there lobbying about changing and reforming the VA itself. They just want to see the pie grow. Here's something that happened. This is a historical thing that occurred in 2005. The Office of Inspector General did a small review of disability adjudications. They went into the files and they concluded that there was a very high percentage of people who had been awarded disability without there being a full due diligence. Information was missing. There were contradictions. There were concerns about how they were evaluated and how they reported. And so what the OIG came out and said was, we want to do a larger scale review and have a larger discussion about the VA's disability policy and how it's being implemented and how it's affecting people. And this was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and they were engaging with Congress on this. The next day, there was a veteran, I think somewhere in Arizona, who died by suicide. I think he shot himself. And on the bed where he lay, where they found him, I believe it was, they found this OIG report.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a note or something. And Congress scrapped it right off the bat. Like the VSOs went in with this story and said, look, we have veterans now killing themselves because you're talking about looking and examining this system. As far as I know, since 2005, it's not even been touched. It's not on the table. It truly is a third rail right now. And I don't think anybody who's not a veteran has a prayer of fixing it. It's going to take veterans to come together and request and compel and force change if it's going to change, if it's going to happen.
So one of the, and I hope this makes sense because it just has kind of occurred to me as you're talking through this, because this is now for us, at least sort of the second, yours and Dan's, this is kind of the second conversation we've had that has somewhat of a criticism for some of these VA policies. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on kind of what is the why behind that criticism? Like, what is fixing that system and potentially freeing up financial resources, man hours? Like, what does that then allow the VA to pivot to as far as a healing body versus, hey, these guys, like, people just want to take my money away, like, you know, blah, 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 blah. I think that there's goodness in this criticism versus just, hey, this whole thing is screwed up. And like I said, I hope that makes some semblance of sense.
I'm no policymaker, and I'm certainly no politician. So this is a little outside my scope. I would love to see the policies changed, but I also completely appreciate the shock wave that that would result in on the veteran community. So I think, like many things, like reforming Social Security, for example, I think you have to figure out what makes sense and then grandfather people into what to the old system, but make a plan that starting at some point in the future, we're phasing this new thing in. I don't know how that looks. I don't know how to do that. That's not my area of expertise. But I do think we have a system that is encouraging people to be sick and is wildly misallocating resources and treatments.
So just to like paint a picture of the scale of the issue here, I don't know how many people realize, but we as a country spend more on veteran disability every year than we spend on treatment for those veterans and their disabilities every year. We're more focused on compensation than we are on treatment and potential resolution of a lot of these conditions. And that leads me to wonder, and this might sound ridiculous, I don't think it's any more ridiculous than the current system, but is there any potential for a model where veterans are rewarded financially for health-seeking behaviors rather than just disability?
Well, I think you've talked with Dan Gade, and he certainly has thoughts on that. That's not really my area of specialty, but I think there is some data and some studies that have been done recently showing that if you incentivize people to work and to get better, that they do much better. They actually make more money. They develop they become healthier, and their families have more income and more money. So part of the tragedy of this system is it actually leaves veterans poorer than otherwise. It seems like easy money, but maybe it's a bit of a Faustian bargain. Now, let's come back around and talk about the VA's treatment. The VA does have a very large workforce of psychologists, social workers, and psychiatrists. It's the largest mental health care system in the entire world. And there are, you know, essentially VA hospitals and clinics in every community across the country. I don't know how much the VA spends, but it's in the billions, right? What is the evidence that veterans are getting better from their care? What is the administrative data? Can the VA say, yes, we spend X billions of dollars on mental health care treatment every year, and here's the percentage of veterans who actually get better from that treatment?
So this brings us back to the incentives issue, right? And not talking about incentives around the veterans themselves, but incentives around the VA, similar to what you mentioned about the VSOs before, and this is going to sound conspiratorial and things like that. I understand that going into it, but
aliens.
Would it be a problem for the VA? Because if the VA got too many veterans better, there would be less work for the VA to do, meaning the VA's budget would shrink. So is there a problem in that the incentive structure for the VA as an institution is to have as many sick and disabled veterans as possible?
I think you're right on that. I think you're spot on. But let's flip it. Let's take a business perspective to this. If you're running a business, most businesses need to show some evidence that the money they're spending is well spent. And depending on the business, that means showing different things. But for the VA, can they show that veterans are getting better for all this money that they're paying for the care that the VA pays for? My belief is they can't, and they won't, and they never have shown that. So why do we keep putting billions of dollars into a healthcare program that has no ability to show one lick of efficacy? Where is that veteran that got better? They should have reams of administrative data. And they do. But I've never seen it. When other people have asked for it, they have not been given it. That to me is the most mystifying piece of all of this. How is it that Congress never asks that question?
Because it's a third rail, as you mentioned. Asking that question would be tantamount to threatening disability.
Wait a second. So just to make sure I'm hearing this correctly. So the funding for the VA is predicated upon this narrative that we are giving you X amount of doubloons to heal veterans. However, comma, if you are to then heal those veterans, we will be giving you less amounts of doubloons. Therefore, just don't show us the data of you actually healing anyone. Is that kind of the game that we're playing here?
It's what I think.
That is fascinating.
Look what China did recently when their youth unemployment numbers were creeping up and up and up and got over 20%. What did China do? They stopped collecting the data.
That's one way to solve it.
Now nobody knows what the youth unemployment rate in China is. The VA system is a little bit like that, I think, right now. All this money going into these treatment programs, and yet they can't show us any evidence that veterans are getting better. There's something wrong with that picture.
And I'm a little bit outside of my scope here, but like, just to be clear, like in a for-profit medical model, you would have to show improvements. I'm assuming any given hospital has to be able to show that they're treating patients, right?
You know, it's complicated. Let's agree on that. It's really complicated. Modern medicine, typically West medicine in America, typically hasn't had enough focus on outcomes.
Yeah.
Let's say I want to start a program and I go to the VA and I go to a donor and I go to a corporation and I say to these three different types of potential funders, I've got a program, I'm going to treat veterans, but I just need the money. So if you'll give me an infusion of cash, I'll treat 1,000 veterans. They're going to ask, well, okay, but what's the evidence that those veterans are getting better? They might fund you for a year, but if you don't have the data to show that veterans are getting better at the end of that year, they're not going to keep funding you.
So is the, I guess, philosophical calculus here an argument between what's the lesser of two evils? Walking back just decades of compensation strategies towards veterans, or asking for outcomes? Like, we've got to choose between those two things. It seems to be a little bit better if we just kind of let it keep going, because if we do ask for outcomes, it might, you know, hey, things actually are being successful, we don't need to fund it, you know, blah, 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 blah. Or you run this risk of like political suicide and basically saying that we need to adjust the compensation strategy.
Yeah. I mean, either way, you have an IED that's going to go off. So better just to leave it alone, not ask questions, not go too deep. The VA knows that it has a problem with overdiagnosing. The VA, I mean, the VA has every reason to know they have a problem with diagnosing. They have every reason to know that there are some small studies pointing to very high rates of deception and malingering of symptoms. My own experience from 2005 was the response to that was not, holy cow, we need to go and dig deeper and learn about this. It was, I was told, shut your mouth. Keep quiet. I was literally told, don't even publish this study because it will raise questions that we don't want to have to answer. And I was bullied pretty ferociously. Dan Gay wrote a chapter of that in his book. I was told my career would be over. I was told I would never be a scientist again. I was investigated in one study. I was formally investigated by Central Office for no reason other than they went looking to see if they could find something maybe I'd done wrong, some I that went undotted or some T that went uncrossed. Fortunately for me, they couldn't find one. So they backed off for a little while. But that's the environment that they're in. So clinicians and researchers in the VA know that they're not supposed to ask certain questions. They're not supposed to say out loud certain things.
Wow. You've almost answered the question I was going to ask you, really. I was going to ask you what it was like being somebody trying to talk about these issues, researching these issues, publishing on these issues well inside the VA. And I've read some of what Dan's written about that, but I know most of our audience hasn't. First off, what pushed you to care enough about the topics to take on that institutional resistance to it? And then second, what has been the actual outcome since you did kind of publicly engage on some of these topics?
Why did I persist? Well, maybe I'm just stubborn. I went to the VA because I wanted to help veterans. I went to graduate school because I wanted to help veterans. But what I found at the VA, and don't get me wrong, I love working at the VA. I love the veterans that I worked with. I have very positive feelings and thoughts about the 15 years I worked at the VA. I had a lot of great colleagues that I worked with. The system is very frustrating, and it became more and more frustrating as I matured from being the very beginning of my career, a few years in, starting to look at data that tapped into kind of what you see day to day, like, it seems like a lot of our patients are not getting better, or aren't really trying to get better, or are misrepresenting certain things. And then when you start going and looking at them systematically with data, you start seeing patterns and things that, you know, you just want to follow. I wanted to follow, but let's pull on this thread. I read Jug Burkett's book, Stolen Valor, that was written in the late 90s. He's a Vietnam veteran. And he wrote a book about all these people that he encountered out in the public eye claiming to be combatants, Vietnam War combatants. And when he did his Freedom of Information Act requests and would dig into their personnel records, he discovered many of them were misrepresenting. So I worked with Jug Burkett and we did a study. We literally did a Freedom of Information Act request on 100 consecutive people coming into our clinic purporting to be Vietnam War veterans. And what we found was pretty shocking once we got their DD-214s. Small percentage of them, very small, were not even veterans, but they were still in the system. That was like a handful. But only about I don't remember the numbers, so I shouldn't say, but less than 50% had a really good match between what they told us they had done and what their DD-214 represented. I think we had 6 or 7 people telling us they were SEALs or Green Berets in Vietnam. They weren't. We had a number of people who talked about being in long-range reconnaissance patrols in Vietnam. They weren't. They were working in offices in Saigon. Not putting their service down. It just didn't match the level of traumatic experiences that they were telling us about. It would not be hard to answer this question very definitively. It would be cheap and easy to do the research to look at this. So why have they not? because they don't want to know is the only answer I can come up with.
I remember, this must have been a podcast, but and you, Jug, I think the guy you just referenced may know this too, but something about a PBS documentary that had come out highlighting like six Vietnam veterans, I think. And it turned out that like none of them had actually served in Vietnam after they dug in. And it was a larger conversation about the Stolen Valor situation, but definitely interesting. I do want to ask, and this could be a close. I mean, I know we're kind of working towards an hour at this point, but if this is within your area of expertise, have you encountered a situation of like a country or a military that is doing veterans affairs well? Not that ours isn't good, but you get what I'm asking?
Yeah. I have impressions, but I haven't really gone and done the true deep dive to understand other countries. But my impression is that Australia has a pretty good VA program for veterans. I think Israel does. Israel has some really good data. They have an insurance program. So if you're in Israel and there's a terror attack, you're injured in any way, whether you're an Israeli citizen or a visitor, tourist even, you are eligible for their insurance program, the special insurance program. And I worked with a team of Israeli doctors on this a couple years ago, and we just published their data about 3 years ago in a study. And what we found was they have very low rates of PTSD from terror attacks, or at least they had prior to, this was a few years ago, very low rates. One of the things that they do, though, is they give everybody an evaluation right away, psychological evaluation, and they provide them with counseling for acute stress response. So they're getting something like right away. And there is this program that's there for them, but it's not a lifetime of disability payments. And their PTSD rates would be shocking to America, would be shockingly low to Americans who might be prone to think that the rates would be higher. Can I offer one more thing?
Please. I know
we're running out of time, but here's a thought that I think probably most people in America don't understand, and no reason why they should understand. But it's this: the VA has a monopoly on veterans. Their research funding, if you want to do research on veterans and you want to apply to the VA for that funding, you have to be a VA employee. So I'm considered to be an academic, whatever, freaking expert on PTSD. That's great. But I'm ineligible to apply for a VA grant myself because I do not work for the VA. Now, anybody can apply to NIH for a grant, but the VA safeguards their grant funding so that only their own employees are eligible to apply for it, which means everybody who's applying for those grants is part of the system. So there's no outside thoughts. There's nobody coming in with ideas who don't have to worry about the VA, central office pressure or whatever the chain of command on them might be. So the only people applying for VA grants are people who are part of the VA. They all know the rules. They all know the things you can say and can't say. They know you can't ask questions about malingering. Now they know you can't ask questions about disability, not real questions. So where do the answers come from? Moreover, the VA even if I got an NIH grant, I could not go into the VA and implement it without the VA's permission. So they really have created a firewall that protects their data and their information. And they only fund the research that's going to be politically expedient.
So it's been a while since I read Dan's book. And I think this was about you. I'm not 100% sure. It's been like a year, I think, since I went through that book. But correct me if I'm wrong here. I believe you like had research ready to publish. Were you like threatened over trying to publish? Like not based on the accuracy of the content. If I recall correctly, they didn't have any criticisms of the methodology or anything.
Correct.
They just saw what the conclusion was, what the results were, and essentially made it clear to you that it was your career or the publication of this research.
It was my mentor, one of the leaders in the PTSD National Centers. And he called me one day from central office and said, I'm sitting here in the, was one of the assistants to the secretary. I don't remember which one, but he said, I'm sitting here in his office and we're looking at this paper that you have submitted for publication. And I'm calling to tell you, you must pull this. You can't publish these findings. They're too explosive. Congress might start asking questions. And he said, if you do, your career will be over. Your scientific career will be over.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, too. It wasn't necessarily like submitted to the assistant secretary's office or anything for publication. It was submitted to a journal for publication. But the community is small enough that the journal contacted central office.
They probably sent it out for review to somebody who shared it with this individual. And maybe he was the one that was the reviewer. And what the journal eventually did, this was the American Journal of Psychiatry. They rejected the paper a few weeks later with basically a two-sentence review saying we can't publish this because if the findings were true, that just would be too explosive. So we're not going to publish this. I submitted it to the British Journal of Psychiatry, also a very top-notch psychiatry journal, and they published it. They had no problem publishing it. But they're outside the American VA system.
I'm like at a loss for words there. And I have so many questions. As a researcher, getting that call, how does that feel?
Oh, well, kind of sucked. Was I surprised? Not really. I mean, I've been taking some arrows for quite some time. And that's the paper that after it was published, I was investigated for. I was not accused of anything. It was just, hey, we're investigating you. We want to know who funded this, why you did the study. Did you have IRB approval? Those kinds of questions.
Which, I mean, I'm assuming you had covered all of those bases and everything was legit. It was just that, like you said, the phrase you used is shocking to me. If this is true, the findings will be too explosive, therefore we will not publish it. Isn't that the point of science?
In theory, yes. In practice, I mean, you guys have been around. You've seen what happened over the last few years. Did scientists who question masks and vaccine mandates, how'd they fare? Were their ideas allowed to air?
That's a podcast for another day. I think there's a conversation. There's a way. This is a conversation I have had today. I think I had this conversation yesterday. I have this conversation routinely. People want the answer to be at one end of the spectrum or the other. You have to fully embrace one of the spectrum and fully oppose the other, and that's comfortable. And I think what we lost, and I think this has had ramifications for military readiness, so I think it's relevant to our podcast when we talk about military health and fitness. I don't want to go down a COVID rabbit hole yet because we're already over the hour mark, and this is a huge can of worms. But I think there was a space in there to acknowledge that there are tools like masks and vaccines and things like that have their place. And there are policies like lockdowns and things like that have their place. And that all of those things also come with consequences that we should be clear about. And that some of those consequences, when we start talking about like childhood development and physical activity and mental health of people under lockdowns and all of these things, I think we picked an end of the spectrum and stuck to that and didn't really have a conversation about some things that might land in the middle of the spectrum that might have been also important.
We didn't have an honest conversation, and we didn't do any kind of cost benefit analysis of any policy.
Which seems to the VA. I mean, that's to make a beautiful loop here. I mean, that's effectively mirroring the conversation we've just had about the functioning of the VA.
Yeah.
Man. Okay, well, here, let's I know we've already got future conversations locked in, but we'll close this one out, Chris, because I want to be appreciative of your time. So, I mean, thank you very, very much for coming on. I know just an insane series of stories, and so many more questions have been uncovered. So we really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here, enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to the next one.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.